The good news comes to us today from John's Gospel, the story that marks the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, unique to the John's Gospel. So I invite you to listen for God's living word to you this day in these words, in this story, and in what follows. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become, let's say, tipsy, drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee and revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. The word of God for the people of God. My first question about this story is, how did Mary know? She appears to make a straightforward observation: they have no wine. The statement also appears to have annoyed Jesus. "Woman, what concern is that to you and me?" My guess is that he hears Mary's comment as a complaint, one that is perhaps also somehow directed at him. But I don't think it's a complaint. At least, that's not how I hear it. I think it's a request, a plea for help. This is a wedding, Jesus, a Jewish wedding. Mordecai and Naomi have paid a lot of money so that this big crowd could gather to celebrate their daughter's special day. They have no wine. This is bad. Maybe even a crisis. Can you please help? Can you do something? In John's Gospel, this is Jesus' first public appearance, public form of ministry, if you will. It's his first miracle. Up to this point, he's done nothing particularly noteworthy, or at least nothing out of the ordinary. Unless, of course, you count being baptized as a gesture of solidarity with all the other unwashed riffraff coming out of Jerusalem to be washed clean by John in the waters of the Jordan ordinary. So how did Mary know to ask Jesus for help? Why did she nudge him to solve the wine shortage? There's actually no way to know the answer to that question apart from wild, extra-textual speculation, making up stuff that's not in the Bible. What was Jesus like as a child, a teenager, a 20-something? It's impossible to say because none of the gospel writers tells us much of anything about Jesus as a young man. He's born, and apart from one short story about Jesus as a 12-year-old in the temple in Jerusalem with his parents, on a trip there with his parents, the next we see of him, he's 30 years old. So we don't know how or why Mary would have cause to believe Jesus could do anything to solve the wine shortage, assuming that was the motivation behind her question or her statement. What we do know is that this is Mary's first appearance in John's Gospel. We also know she disappears for the rest of the story for the next 3 years and does not turn up again until the crucifixion. So I think it's safe to assume that narratively she appears here in this crisis moment for a reason. So that's my second question. What's the reason? Why is she there? The answer to that question, I think, is much easier. I believe it's because, ultimately, this is not a story about a wedding. It's a story meant to show the reader Jesus' identity, to give us insight into the nature of his mission. It falls to Mary to prompt him to act, to reveal his glory, as the text says. That is, to make manifest, to reveal to the world for the first time the extravagant grace that fuels his mission, the lavish generosity that lies at the heart of his identity. And that story, that mission, starts with a miracle of transformation and abundance. Boom! Right out of the gate, John shows us what Jesus' mission and ministry is going to look like. For Jesus doesn't just make a little wine. He makes a lot of wine. And he doesn't just make enough to cover for Mordecai and Naomi and the lucky couple and their guests, however many there may be. He makes enough for everyone in the entire region, whether they're at the wedding that day or not. 20 or 30 gallons times 6. Do the math. It's a lot. I believe I may have mentioned before that this story always makes me think of what may be my favorite billboard of all time. It's very striking. You may remember it yourself. The top of the sign of the billboard pictured an old-fashioned spigot with a stream of clear water running out of it. At the bottom of the billboard stood a wine glass, half full of what looked like, say, a dark red Cabernet. Somewhere in between the spigot and the glass, the water turned to wine. Off to the side, read a simple two-word question: got faith. Obviously a play on got milk, only for folks like us. In this post-enlightenment world in which we live, it's taken for granted that seeing is believing. Even more than that, it's assumed that seeing is a kind of precondition for believing, that if a given thing can't be seen, if it can't be proven, then it's not real. It is further assumed that if a given thing is seen or can be measured or proven, then it's not a miracle. It's just part of the real world, the ordinary world that's governed by the laws of physics and chemistry, biology. So that's what science teaches us, and it's a fair point. After all, the scientific method has itself transformed the world from a place governed by superstition to a place where it's possible to cure polio and leukemia, which is itself a kind of miracle when you think about it. Faith, for its part, tells us a different story. It teaches us that sometimes you have to believe before you can see. Sometimes you have to get past your own fixed ideas, your own fixed assumptions about what's possible and what's not possible before, boom, you have your categories remade. But it's also true that sometimes you don't have to believe before you see the miracle. Sometimes you just have to see what's right in front of you to realize you're face to face, nose to nose, with wonders so profound they reshape your understanding of the ordinary world and what's possible in it. Suppose you're out camping somewhere deep in Pisgah National Forest. It's January, so it's bitterly cold out, and a deep layer of snow, in this case, let's say it's just this past week, a deep layer of snow blankets the world all around you. But you were born in Maine and raised in Minnesota. Go Vikings. Can I get an amen? Anybody? There we go. So not surprisingly, you're one of those hardy souls who actually likes winter camping. Now, it happens that night is rapidly falling. It can't be more than 2 or 3 degrees above zero out. You would love to be able to enjoy a hot meal before you crawl in your tent and zip yourself up for the night into your down sleeping bag. But you've brought no stove, and you're at least 10 miles from the nearest source of electricity. Yet you don't really care. You don't mind much because you have a box of small little sticks of wood in your pocket. The tips of these sticks are covered with a glob of sulfur mixed with some oxidizing agents. So following the lesson your father taught you and his father taught him before you arrived, you search out the nearest evergreen tree, reach down underneath its protective boughs, and you harvest a bounty of old, dead, perfectly dry branches and a handful of powder dry moss. You carefully lay some kindling on top of the moss in a perfect pile, like your father showed you how to do. And then you take out one of these little sticks from your pocket. You reach down and you dust off some snow from a rock, pick it up, turn it over, and on the dry underside of that rock, you strike the match. The little blob of chemicals instantly bursts into flame, turning this small piece of wood into a living thing, like a tiny little dragon with a life of its own, a life and energy. You touch the flame to the moss, and instantly, this dry old tuft of fuzz also bursts into life, hot orange flames dancing up from its once dead fibers. Slowly, you add more wood to the flames until a good-sized campfire has lit up the night all around you. 5 minutes ago, it was completely dark. 5 minutes ago, you once were blind. But now, well, now you see. Because now light and heat radiate from old dead logs, brightening up a cold winter's night that was so deep. Suddenly, boom, you realize you caused this astounding transformation. You caused it. You did this by striking a tiny inert matchstick against the bottom of an old, cold rock. You stop and you ponder. What a remarkable thing. What a stupendously wondrous thing this transformation is. Sure, yes, obviously, science can explain what just happened. Science helped make it possible by inventing the match that started the fire. But as far as miracles go, on this cold, dark night, generating light and heat from cold, dead logs stands on a par, in your mind at least, with turning water into wine. Now, you'd be happy to ponder this wondrous thing, this fantastic transformation, for hours, except you realize how hungry you are. It's your first night out, so you break out the fresh food you brought, the packet of mushrooms to add to your can of potato soup, and the lemon you brought to add zest to the final mix. You plop all of that into a pot and place that on a hot rock next to the fire. Within minutes, you begin to smell your dinner. And then, boom, you realize you're party to another stupendous transformation. The simmering food, is sending out little molecules into the air, like sparks from the wood on your fire, only these are sparks of scent, not flame, not things you can see, but rather things you can smell. Their energy hits not the rods and the cones in the back of your eye, but the sense receptors in your nose. These receptors, this is where it really gets interesting, these receptors then fire and send electrochemical impulses to your brain. These impulses bear no resemblance at all to the molecules wafting up out of your pot of stew. The direct connection to mushrooms, potatoes, and lemons has been lost completely. Because these impulses are no longer molecules wafting through the air. They're electrical things, electrochemical impulses running down your neural pathways from your nose to your brain. And yet somehow, when they reach your temporal lobes, right here, these electrochemical bursts are transformed back into something you can experience, something you can smell. Now again, you'd be happy to ponder how this could possibly be. You're having an experience in your head coming from those things out there, and it smells like those things. How could this possibly be? Happy to ponder that, except you're now really hungry, ravenous, in fact. So you put a spoonful of soup, of stew in your mouth, and boom. You realize that yet another miraculous transformation has occurred. Molecules from the lemon and the mushrooms and the potatoes kiss the tiny little taste buds on your tongue, which in turn fire and send yet more electrochemical signals to your brain. Only now these signals are not transformed into the experience of smell. They're transformed into the experience of taste. Taste you can differentiate. Mushrooms, potatoes, lemon. You think, world of wonders. Light from logs. Smell and taste from tiny molecules hitting your nose and your tongue. You ponder why hymns are not written about such astounding transformations. And you would be right to ponder that. Indeed. That's why you come to church every Sunday, to find a place to focus your awe. A sacred space to worship and to give thanks to the God who created a world that is both governed by the laws of science and chocked so full of wonders as to blow your mind. And then, boom, you realize that here in this place, we are all party to still more miracles, because every week, the cash and checks and pledges you place in the offering plate are turned into ministry. $20 bills are turned into light and heat. $30 checks are turned into the bread and the wine we use for communion. $50 pledge payments are used to buy baby wipes in our nursery and the paper for our bulletins and sheet music for the choir. But more than just things you can taste and see, things you can touch and hear, these gifts are turned into love. They're turned into collections of food for our hungry neighbors. They allow groups to form, which then advocate for the rights of immigrants and refugees. They allow us to host meals for hungry students who have nowhere else to go on Thanksgiving, and to light candles of joy and concern as we offer up our prayers together. This wondrous transformation from money to ministry is yet another sign that the world is brimming with wonder. Another example of God's extravagant grace and lavish generosity, but not just God's generosity. Yours too. So on behalf of the 2017 stewardship team, it's my duty today and my privilege today to thank you for your incredible generosity. As you'll hear in more detail at our congregational meeting in just a few minutes, we finished this past year in the black, and we exceeded our challenge budget, our challenge goal for 2018, which means we won't just be able to keep the lights on and the heat running. We'll be able to keep turning your pledges into ministry, your cash and your checks into tangible expressions, things you can see and hear and touch and taste. Tangible expressions of God's love made manifest for us and for the world. Thanks be to God.